Hi, I'm Shirin Jafari. I'm a reporter for The World, where I often cover the Middle East. Recently, I've been on the ground covering the ongoing war in Ukraine. Take my recent coverage about Russia's strategy of targeting Ukraine's infrastructure using drone attacks. Or my interview with Victoria Abidina, a young Ukrainian medic and mother who spent 6 months as a prisoner of war before finally being released earlier this fall. You may already know this, but it takes a lot of work to bring stories like this to you. Even a segment that's only a few minutes long is built on months, sometimes years, of establishing sources and building relationships. This work is crucial, and it's crucial that we do it well. But we can't do it without financial support from listeners like you. From now through December 31st, The World is participating in Newsmatch, a fundraising movement for nonprofit newsrooms like ours. We recently learned that a generous donor has offered to match gifts to The World before December 31st up to $67,000. But we need to raise that entire amount to unlock the match. We have a long way to go. I really hope you consider supporting our work so we can keep on bringing The World to you. You can learn more and donate at theworld.org/give. Thank you. And now, the show.
Over in Europe, it costs a lot more to heat your home, and some Europeans are pointing their fingers at an old ally.
What people see is the difference in the prices in the U.S. versus the prices of gas in Europe. And say, well, somebody has to be pocketing that windfall.
Also ahead, Spain's healthcare system is highly respected, but patients and doctors have reached a breaking point. This doctor said medical professionals have no life.
You know, it's crazy. You work so many hours a day in a week.
I'm Carol Hills. Plus, what's for dessert at the Nobel Prize dinner this weekend in Stockholm? It's a big deal.
It's something in the air, so you can actually feel the tension in the kitchens.
And when your World Cup team gets knocked out, how do you pick a new one to root for? That's all ahead. On The World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. It's been 9 long months of war in Ukraine. Through it all, the West has remained largely united against Russia, except when it comes to gas and energy. There have been big disputes among European nations about how to deal with Russian gas, to buy, not to buy, how much to buy. Now there are signs that the relationship between the U.S. and Europe, while strong, is beginning to fray. It comes down to allegations of war profiteering. The World's Sarah Birnbaum reports.
French President Emmanuel Macron was stateside last week for an official visit with President Joe Biden. There were moments during this 3-day extravaganza where it was like watching a lovey-dovey couple at dinner.
We stand together, shoulder to shoulder, precisely to be entitled to say...
Ladies and gentlemen, to the history that binds us and the values that still unite us, and to the future we're going to forge together.
Why this extreme show of affection? The more skeptical political analysts would say it's because under the surface, all is not well with the transatlantic alliance. In France, Le Figaro, a central right-leaning newspaper, is running editorials accusing the U.S. of profiteering from the war in Ukraine. That sentiment is widespread in Europe, says Gilles Paris, a columnist with Le Monde, a center-left newspaper in France.
For many Europeans, the U.S. are benefiting in a way from this war in Ukraine.
Basically, the reasoning goes, the EU imposed sanctions on Russia. In retaliation, Russia cut gas supplies. So now Europe is relying on other places for that fuel, like the U.S. And again, some in Europe say they're suffering while Americans are reaping the profits. This argument isn't just contained to the editorial pages.
Les États-Unis sont producteurs d'un gaz peu cher.
President Macron, before he went to Washington, complained the U.S. wasn't being friendly, that liquefied natural gas, or LNG, coming from the U.S. was way too expensive. In Germany, same thing.
Einige Länder, auch befreundete, erzielen teils Mondpreise.
Germany's economy minister Robert Habeck made news when he criticized the U.S. for profiting from astronomical gas prices. In some ways, the Europeans speaking out have a point. LNG is 3 to 4 times more expensive in Europe than it is in the U.S. It comes to Europe via huge tanker ships. Most of that gas was already spoken for on its way to countries like Pakistan. So European companies had to bid enough money to convince the tankers to break their long-term contracts and reroute to Europe. That's expensive. Anna Mikulska at the Baker Institute at Rice University says there's no way around it. To compete for gas, Europe has to pony up.
It needs to provide the higher prices. And that's where you go into this, you know, almost vicious cycle, because you have to compete. So you have to bid higher in order to motivate the tankers that you have not contracted, motivate them to come over.
That's basic market economics, but not what most people are seeing.
What people see is the difference in the prices in the U.S. versus the prices of gas in Europe. And say, well, somebody has to be pocketing that windfall.
So who is? Well, it's not the American government, says Mikulska, or even American gas producers. Not to say American companies aren't doing well, because they are. But they're not the ones reaping most of the benefits of the tight markets Europe is complaining about. Mikulska says that would be the middlemen.
These are not U.S. companies. These are companies in Europe. These are companies in Asia. And these are the middlemen or the traders whose job is to trade on the gas market and make money.
Companies like Total Energies, based in France. It made a $6.6 billion profit in the third quarter of this year. That's 43% more than the same time last year. And Shell, based in Britain, is also raking in huge profits. So, to sum up, when European politicians point the finger at Uncle Sam, that might be politically expedient at home, but the reality is a lot more complicated. For The World, I'm Sarah Birnbaum.
Our next story is about hardware and relationships. Today, Japan announced a new partnership with the UK and Italy to develop a state-of-the-art fighter jet. The Mitsubishi FX fighter jet will replace a fleet of older jets that Japan developed with the U.S. Becca Wasser is a senior fellow at the Center for a New American Security. She joins us from Washington. Becca, how big of a deal is this announcement?
Well, this is a pretty big deal for a few different reasons. First, it is a demonstration of the need for advanced future capabilities to meet what seems to be a growing military challenge from China in the Indo-Pacific. It's also a big deal in terms of defense industry and the ways in which various countries are banding together to, you know, get more bang for their buck and enter into these co-production agreements in order to do this. But this also means that there are some industrial rivalries that are going strong, because this program now stands in contrast to the one that France, Spain, and Germany are trying to develop in terms of also having an advanced fighter jet.
What does it mean in terms of the countries involved? Let's start with Japan.
So for Japan, I think it really demonstrates a growing shift in how Japan views its role in the Indo-Pacific. For a very long time, based in part on some of its constitutional priorities, Japan has predominantly been focused on self-defense. That still remains true, but there's this growing idea about collective self-defense. You see Japan talking about protection of Taiwan, and you see this growing change in how Japan believes it can best ensure its own security.
What about Italy?
So Italy is a really interesting one. And here I think it's a little bit less of a grand security role and more about Italy's domestic industry. You know, these co-production agreements are great because it enables, you know, these countries to pool together resources to, you know, at the end have this state-of-the-art equipment that is more than the sum of its parts. But it also means that Italy is going to be able to have job retention and job creation in its domestic defense industry. And if you look at Italy's economy right now, that's a huge boon for them. So, you know, for Italy, I think it's more about the basic economics.
And finally, the UK.
So the UK, I think it's a mix of everything here. The UK has been taking on a bigger role in the Indo-Pacific. You see this in a lot of their strategy documents, but also as a result of Brexit, there is this economic need in the United Kingdom to ensure that its domestic defense industry is alive and well. So this enables the United Kingdom to ensure that they too are taking care of their own citizens by strengthening their domestic economy and creating jobs.
And significantly, one big country that's not involved is the U.S. How big of a deal is it that they're not part of this partnership?
You know, I don't think that it is a demonstration of massive fractures in, you know, the UK-US relationship or the U.S.-Japan relationship, but rather I think it's indicative of a frustration that I've heard time and time again from U.S. allies and partners, including folks in Japan and the United Kingdom. And these frustrations are really about barriers to military cooperation, things like withholding cutting-edge technology. They include export controls that limit the sharing of technical information that make it hard to do upgrades and ensure that the United States would be a key primary when it came down to upgrades and maintenance of the aircraft. It also is about some of the U.S. regulation that really demonstrates a U.S. preference against co-production. This is an element of protectionism, but it also means that a state like Japan couldn't be intimately involved in the development of the aircraft.
Wow, that's really interesting, because it's sort of like these three other countries saying, no, we got this. We got enough talent and know-how, and we can produce this stuff, and we can actually do it better. That's kind of what they're saying.
Yeah, and you can also view that as potentially a hedging strategy, reminding the United States that while their partnerships are strong and that military cooperation is strong, that if they're not able to get what they need in terms of capability development, in terms of information sharing, that they have other options and that they will go it alone to ensure that they can take care of their own security and their own economies.
Becca Wasser is a senior fellow at the Center for a New American Security. She's been talking about Japan's new partnership with Italy and the UK to build a next generation fighter jet. Thanks a lot for speaking with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
This week, a Canadian company called The Captioning Group put out a list of the most mispronounced words of the year. Here at The World, we were waiting for the list with bated breath. In radio, words need to be spoken authoritatively, without hesitation. That can be a challenge, even for people who do it constantly.
All right, I'm ready to embarrass myself here.
Our reporters, producers, engineers, and editors were given the list, then told to go for it and give it their unrehearsed best shot.
Chick-u-lub.
Chick-su-lub.
Chick-su-lub.
That's almost there. Chick-chu-lub. It's the name of a crater in the Gulf of Mexico. It was in the news this year when scientists learned that it was created by an asteroid, the one that likely caused the extinction of the dinosaurs. Chick-chu-lub is one of the most mispronounced words of 2022. Here are some other words in the news this year that have been frequently mangled, like the first name of the Irish actor who called out talk show host Stephen Colbert for mispronouncing his first name. Our staff didn't do much better.
Domhnall.
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 It's Donal. Full name, Donal Gleeson. Another name now, the capital city of Scotland, spelled E-D-I-N-B-U-R-G-H. During coverage of the memorial for Queen Elizabeth II in September, some news anchors, not ours, pronounced the name as it is spelled. But that is wrong. Our UK reporter got it right.
Edinburgh.
That is correct. How about the Serbian tennis star who was barred from competing in the Australian Open? Our staff nailed that.
Novak Djokovic.
Novak Djokovic.
Perfection. Novak Djokovic made the news after being deported for failing to comply with Australia's COVID vaccination rules. Here's another word from the world of sports.
Ohtani rule.
Ohtani rule.
Ohtani rule.
That's right, the Ohtani rule. It's from Major League Baseball. It's named after the 2021 American League Most Valuable Player, Shohei Ohtani. The rule became official this year. It allows a starting pitcher to stay in the game as the designated hitter even after leaving the mound. And now one last word, also from the world of sports. And up front, we offer apologies to the Miami Dolphins quarterback, whose name we're just getting to learn.
Tuani Gama Nalupeola Tagovailoa. I know that's not right.
Tunamgamanapola Tagovailoa.
Tuani Gamanu Olepola.
I'll let the sportscasters handle this one.
The full name, Tuaninga Manu Olapola Tagovailoa.
Second down and 10, Tagovailoa. Tagovailoa throws and gets a first down.
some of this year's most mispronounced words. You can pronounce our name, and you can find us at theworld.org. Coming up, silver trays of ice cream mark one special night in Stockholm. Can you guess which one? You're with The World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. The healthcare system in Spain has a great reputation, well-trained doctors, top-notch hospitals. But the publicly funded network is facing huge problems right now. Patients are waiting months for basic services. Doctors are not happy either. Jerry Haddon has the story from Barcelona.
On a recent morning in one of Barcelona's many primary care clinics, patients line up to see their family doctors. They're really the foundation of Spain's healthcare system. A patient needs the family doctor's nod to see a specialist, say for a bad back or knee surgery or even cancer screenings. But even before that, you need an appointment. A young father named Edgar Ochandorena is leaving this clinic with his 2-year-old daughter Aisha in his arms. She has the flu. Ochandorena says he bucked the system, brought Aisha in without calling ahead.
Claro, porque si no pides cita y te la dan dentro de unos días, igual ya sea curado. ¿Sabes? Cuando esto ya no hace falta.
If I'd called for an appointment, he says, she would have been better by the time I'd gotten it. Ochandorena's strategy worked today, but he says for routine stuff, there's no way around the scheduling, and in recent years, that's been taking forever.
A veces tienes visitas normales o necesarias y te dan 6 meses.
Sometimes when you need like a normal checkup or follow-up, they give you a time slot that's 4, 5, or 6 months out. Ochandorena says his wife's postpartum checkups got scheduled so far in the future, they weren't even necessary. Luckily, he says, she didn't have any complications. Spain's healthcare system used to be more efficient, but a combination of COVID-19 plus poaching by other European countries has drained the system of funds and talent. Authorities have been asking family doctors to work more, see more patients, but physicians say they're maxed out. From Madrid to Sevilla, doctors have been going on strike this fall, calling on the government to raise their salaries and lower caseloads. Right now, doctors get only 7 or 8 minutes per patient. In Barcelona, family doctor Chantal Ferré says the COVID pandemic nearly collapsed the healthcare system back in 2020, and it still hasn't bounced back. At 8 p.m. on a recent evening, she calls in her last patient of the day. With my final patient, she says, we were just chatting for a bit about the worry she has about her health. There's nothing wrong with her specifically, she says. She just needed someone to talk to. Ferré says she sometimes feels as much bartender as doctor, but she says getting to know patients personally is at the heart of a family doctor's work.
Es entender que tú estás no tratando enfermedades, sino personas o enfermos, a veces no están enfermos, personas.
People need to understand we don't treat illnesses, she says. We treat people. What's going on with the patient I've known for 20 years, right now, today, and how is that affecting their health? Are they sick, she says, or are there other things going on in their lives that I need to know about? Developing that personal connection can't happen in 8 minutes, she says, or even 15. Physicians in Barcelona are planning to strike next month. Family doctor Esther Ross says the government needs to pay doctors, especially young ones, much more, or lose them. Physicians just out of the gate now earn about $1,000 a month.
Pero es que España es una cantera de médicos, es una mina.
Spain's a doctor factory, she says. We train them well, and we have enough coming out of medical school. But we do it on the cheap, she says, and the rest of Europe knows this, and lures them away with better pay and better conditions. Ross knows this well. She recently lost a young family doctor she'd been training for years here in Barcelona.
You don't have like a life, you know, it's crazy. You work so many hours a day and a week.
Family doctor Susana Fontana threw in the towel last year and accepted a job offer in Dublin, Ireland. She says she doubts she'll ever leave.
Usually doctors here, they don't work 5 days a week. They work 4, even 3 days a week. And also the salary for sure. It's like maybe 3 or 4 times even more than Barcelona.
Regional health authorities did not respond to my request for an interview, but the central government here in Spain has indicated it's willing to negotiate better compensation for healthcare workers, especially family doctors. If something isn't done, this country will likely lose thousands more doctors in the coming years. For The World, I'm Jerry Haddon in Barcelona.
Sweden's Nobel Prize banquet returns this weekend for the first time since the pandemic. For attendees, there's a lot to look forward to. The prestigious prizes, of course, and a performance by Canadian singer Rufus Wainwright, who released a clip of himself rehearsing in Stockholm. For decades, though, the highlight of the evening has been what happens at the very end of the meal. The World's Bianca Hillier has the story.
Ulrika Sutherland first worked the Nobel banquet back in 1989. A trained chef, she was in the cold part of the kitchen.
We would make the starters and the dessert.
Cooking for the fine dining event, held every December in Stockholm City Hall, had been Sutherland's goal since she was a high school student in Sweden. And once she got there, it felt just as special and high stakes as she'd imagined.
It's something in the air, so you can actually feel the tension in the kitchens.
Part of the pressure comes from knowing who are among the 1,300 dinner guests, like the Swedish royal family and Nobel Prize winners.
It's unbelievable, the intelligence that are sitting in that room.
But there's also pressure to do justice to one of the long-held Nobel banquet traditions, the ice cream.
We have ice cream in the very first year.
Since the banquet began in 1901, ice cream has routinely been served for dessert at the end of the multi-course meal. The sweet treat got an extravagant upgrade in 1976, when what's now known as the ice cream parade got started. Dramatic music sets the tone as white-gloved waiters walk in synchrony down a grand staircase. They hold silver trays of dessert above their shoulders, and the entire hall is dark, save for candlelight from tables and sparklers on each of the waiters' platters. Sutherland says waiters rehearse their descent many times before the big day. This spectacular presentation, and the delicious ice cream, has been called the highlight of the evening ever since.
The general gist was, oh, this was nice, let's do it again, and then let's do it again.
Olof Sommel is the curator of the Nobel Prize Museum and has helped with the banquet since 2006. He says the specifics of the desserts have changed over the years. Sometimes dinner guests get ice cream, sometimes they get sorbet. The flavors have changed, too. Menus started out with a heavy French influence, but now they typically stay local to Sweden.
In terms of the produce that is used, in terms of the methods, etc. So we tend to see sort of Swedish berry sorbets, etc. This is an experience that is happening here that you won't find anywhere else.
Like every year, Sommel says this year's Nobel banquet menu is top secret until the night of.
It's totally tight-lipped.
But he can say that chef Jimmy Eriksson and pastry chef Annie Hesselstad have been planning the menu for months and have been preparing in the kitchen since Wednesday morning. Chef Hesselstad hinted at this year's dessert on Radio Sweden.
I'm going to use Swedish plums in the menu.
As for Chef Ulrika Söderlund, she no longer works the Nobel banquet, but she's still just as invested in the event.
I am being glued to the television every 10th of December.
The dinner will be broadcast live tomorrow night on Swedish TV. For The World, I'm Bianca Hillier.
More stories from around the globe still coming your way this hour. You're with The World. In China, captive tigers are a high-end luxury trade.
Tiger skin decor, some traditional medicine products. And the U.S. had no clout because our situation here was completely out of control.
No longer, though, Congress has clamped down. That's ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. More than a billion people around the world are estimated to live in informal settlements or slums. That often means homes that are built illegally and precariously on floodplains or steep slopes, often not connected to basic infrastructure like sewage systems. In the age of climate change, these communities have become even more vulnerable as storms grow stronger and rainfall more intense. We sent The World's Carolyn Beeler to Karachi, Pakistan, to see what that looks like.
On July 13th, Buta Masihi ate breakfast at home like always.
Then the pastor and grandfather walked out the front door and slipped on a path flooded by monsoon rains. He fell into a drainage ditch, swollen to 20 feet deep. We were helpless, says his wife, Parveen Masihi, standing on the spot where he slipped. She tells me no one knew how to swim. His body was in front of us, Bhutta's son, Sohail Masihi, says, but we couldn't get it out of the water. Bhutta had lived in this informal settlement for 50 years. His wife said he was a loving man, a good provider, well-respected. Their house is near the edge of a wide ditch that carries stormwater, sewage, and trash from Karachi out to sea. The house always flooded a little during the monsoon, but they'd never considered it dangerous before. Before this incident, nothing had happened like this, Sohail Masihi says. Emergency responders eventually came. His family tells me the water was so black with sewage, it took over an hour for them to retrieve Bhutta Masihi's body.
Do you want to leave here?
Yes.
Yes, we
Sohail and Parveen Masihi say they both want to leave, but they don't have the money to rent or buy a house anywhere else. They're members of Pakistan's Christian minority, one of the poorest in the country, and don't legally own the land their house is on. A UN climate report this year found that the poor and those living in informal settlements, people like the Masihis, are the ones most vulnerable to the impacts of global warming in urban areas. The news of this past year has provided plenty of examples.
The death toll from the recent floods
in April, deadly floods around Durban, South Africa, hit the city's townships particularly hard.
Authorities say it's the worst flooding in decades, and experts are linking the storms to climate change.
In South Korea's capital region, a deluge.
The water came to Seoul in August.
Store owners and basement apartment dwellers in low-lying areas rushing to escape the rising waters.
A family died drowning in their basement apartment, a style of housing originally built as bunkers and not intended for permanent living. David Satterthwaite has helped write UN reports on climate adaptation in urban areas. He says illegally built homes are often unsafe and often built in risky areas.
Because it cheapens the cost of the house. So they're doubly disadvantaged.
Satterthwaite says that in the 1970s and 80s, cities would frequently just bulldoze these communities. And he's worried that may become a trend again.
And you can see people concerned with climate change looking at these informal settlements and thinking, okay, we've got to move these people. It's too dangerous for them. They then adopt the same techniques as forcibly move the people.
But Satterthwaite says this is a bad idea.
Government schemes to try and move people living in some of the most dangerous sites have almost never worked because they impose solutions on the inhabitants.
So those solutions aren't really solutions. Take the Masihi family's next-door neighbor in Karachi. The government recently demolished the front rooms of Elizabeth Yunus's house. They were trying to clear land around the flood-prone drainage ditch. But now she's just living in the back rooms that are still standing. Everywhere else costs too much. We can't even afford food. How can we pay the expensive rents in other parts of the city, she says. David Satterthwaite says community-driven solutions to climate risk tend to work better. He points to a different informal settlement in Karachi where authorities planned to demolish 1,000 flood-prone homes. But then the community mapped the area, revealing dozens of drains clogged by sewage and trash that made flooding worse.
So they made a whole plan.
Architect Arif Hassan advised on the project. He says the communities argued those drains could be cleared and most of the homes spared.
The decisions that were taken after this reduced the number of affected families from over 1,000 to about 58.
Back in front of the Masihi's home, there's a government-led fix in the works. An earth mover is widening the drainage ditch and building a wall to separate it from the neighborhood. But until Karachi builds formal sewage and trash systems in the area, people here fear clogging will keep causing flooding. For now, the family has built a homemade barrier of corrugated metal along the drainage ditch. After this incident, we think this might happen again, Sohail Masihi tells me. So we put this barricade up, and then other people followed.
They say it won't stop floodwaters from breaching the banks of the drainage ditch, but it might at least stop someone else from slipping in. For The World, I'm Carolyn Beeler, Karachi, Pakistan.
Those summer floods in Seoul, South Korea, put a spotlight on informal basement apartments common in the city. The apartments are called banjihas. That style of living got some notice on the big screen a few years back. In the movie Parasite, which won the Oscar for Best Picture, heavy rains flood an entire Seoul neighborhood and nearly kill the main characters who live in a basement apartment. That fictional scenario became a horrifying reality for one family in August when they became trapped and died in their home underground. After the floods, city officials in Seoul vowed to phase out the banjiha-style apartments. I'm joined by Korean housing policy expert Kyungho Che, who's director of the Tenure Neutrality Research Center in Seoul. Kyungho, can you describe what a banjiha apartment is and how they came into being?
Literally, it means half or semi-basement. They're either basement or ground floor. If you can make a window in the upper part of the wall, then you still have some air, fresh air, and then they call this like semi-basement.
So how did these banjiha apartments come into being?
The division of North and South Korea is one of a big reason. They made it mandatory to make air raid shelter in houses. Informally, it started to get used as private rental housing, poor families. And secondly, industrialization and concentration to the capital region would be a reason. We can see banjihas are only in Seoul and surrounding cities, but not in other parts of Korea. Thirdly, public housing in Korea is built according to minimum living standard, and it's a bit too small for families. Also, most of public housing is located in the outskirts of the city, so it's not really favorable for people who have to work in downtown.
How many of these banjiha-style apartments are there? I mean, is it hundreds, thousands? What are we talking about?
It's around 300,000. So it's quite a lot.
The deaths this past summer, they were really tragic. But it prompted the city government in Seoul to say they were going to phase out the banjiha-style apartments. Are they doing what they said they do?
They can always announce plans, but unfortunately, there's not really much progress on actual concrete actions.
Is there a way to keep these kinds of apartments but make them safer, or are they just inherently dangerous?
Even before this incident, people were saying that it's not good for your health because of mold and also radon. With some radioactive elements. And also the privacy and security was a weak point. So they made some bars in the window for security, and then this made them impossible to escape during this flood.
What is the connection between climate change and informal or unsafe housing in Seoul?
In this case, it was sudden concentration of rain, and the urban infrastructure was not ready for this many water in short period of time. But there is like a dilemma or a trilemma, because a house should be a shelter, but also sometimes it's the cause of these problems. Some countermeasures they are talking is also facing some same dilemma, like water barriers. They say they should install water barriers in the windows and the doors of these banjihas. They need them to protect their lives. But if we think more closely, then those water barriers would only make waters go to the other lower part of the city and make the water go more faster and send more water at more short time. So if there's people who are living in the lower part, then it'll cause more problem for them. Climate change is giving us some challenges that we were not used to before.
If you had the ear of the Seoul government, what would you tell them to do? What's the most urgent thing they could do to improve the situation?
Well, the central government and the metropolitan government both decreased some budget for the public housing. So I hope they restore that budget, and always do not forget that there's actually people living in there right now. So if you just approach that matter only in a hardware point of view, then you will miss actual human life inside it.
Have you ever been inside a banjiha-style apartment?
Yeah, I think I lived there like twice in my life.
So you've lived in a banjiha?
it's not that rare for like university students if you do not go into a dormitory. Maybe at least few months or a year you would live in Pangyeo. In my case, I became a friend with a stray cat outside my window, but I was lucky not to go through any flood.
Kyung-ho Che is a housing policy expert and director of the Tenure Neutrality Research Center. He's been speaking to us from Seoul, South Korea. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
The pandemic is not over, but the global demand for vaccines has dropped, and now one of the key partners with COVAX, that's the effort to bring vaccines to people around the world, is making a controversial decision. The nonprofit Gavi has announced that it will cease distribution of COVID-19 vaccines to middle-income countries. To find out what that means, we're joined by Lawrence Gostin. He's the director of the O'Neill Institute for National and Global Health Law at Georgetown University Law School. He joins us from Washington. Lawrence, first off, remind us what Gavi is.
So basically, it's a global public-private partnership that brings vaccines to the world.
So now Gavi has decided to drop the distribution of COVID-19 vaccines to middle-income countries. What's behind that decision?
Global demand for COVID vaccines has plummeted, and that you've got a glut, a surplus of vaccines. Gavi in particular has purchased vaccines, which has well exceeded its demand. I know when talking to the White House, for example, the White House was offering vaccines to sub-Saharan Africa and other countries, and they were falling on deaf ears. It turns out that people are kind of looking at COVID-19 as if it were in the rearview mirror. But of course, it's far from in the rearview mirror.
So is the issue that the countries don't want the vaccines because they have enough and everyone's getting vaccinated, or they're just not focused on COVID vaccines as something that's urgent?
It's absolutely the latter. And it's sad for me to say that, but it's true. No, these countries, a lot of the middle-income countries and also low-income countries, have very low COVID-19 vaccination rates. And that puts their populations at risk, and particularly the elderly and vulnerable populations. And when Gavi stops providing them for 37 middle-income countries, that could mean that you could have a lot of excess deaths that would have been preventable.
But isn't Gavi kind of being forced into that position because a lot of countries simply aren't using the vaccines or taking them? So Gavi is spending money getting vaccines. Nobody wants them. I mean, is it genuinely feel that COVID's in the rearview mirror, or are they just kind of responding to how the country's disinterest in it?
Oh, I think they're just responding. I mean, I don't fault Gavi at all. I mean, if I were in Gavi's position, and I've talked to them a lot about this, it does make sense because they can't keep, you know, having these surplus vaccines. They can't have their purchasing commitments exceeding their demands. I mean, what we need is a lot of health education and vaccine education around the world. We tend to think in America that, you know, we've got anti-vaxxers and we're exceptional. But the truth is that in many, many countries around the world, both low and middle income countries, you see nations that simply say, I don't want vaccines.
If middle-income countries are saying they have other global priorities now besides coronavirus, what are they?
Oh, they would. One of the big ones is malaria, which is a huge driver of disease. AIDS and tuberculosis, of course, are part of it. Childhood immunizations, increasing the capacity of national health systems that got stretched during COVID-19. And then, of course, things like what we call non-communicable diseases, heart disease, diabetes, and cancer, all have been neglected, and we're seeing cases going up around the world.
If middle-income countries change their mind and suddenly decide this winter, oh no, we really need these COVID vaccines, will they be able to get them?
Well, Gavi's giving them a once-only injection of capital to try to improve their capacities to provide COVID-19 vaccines. Whether that's going to be enough is unsure. But one of the potential problems of all of this is if you don't give emergency access to vaccines in 37 middle-income countries, that you might get an explosion of cases that might come back and bite the United States and other high-income countries. You know, the truth is that we need to do both. We need to focus on the old priorities, which is childhood vaccination, AIDS, TB, malaria. We need to look at all of the problems of cardiac disease and diabetes and cancer and COVID. It can't be either or.
Lawrence Gostin is the director of the O'Neill Institute for National and Global Health Law at Georgetown University Law School. He's been speaking to us from Washington. Thanks so much.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be with you.
News can be overwhelming. Believe me, even those of us who work in the news business feel it. But we're inspired every time we come across the story of someone helping to make a situation better. Toddlers easing the loneliness of senior citizens in Canada. A woman in rural Guatemala who feeds stranded migrants. Or a chef in Ghana who has turned from fine dining to feeding the hungry. Those are some stories that aired recently on The World. We're also looking for your stories of people helping other people. Tell us about the time a friend or stranger helped you get through a tough time. Email a short voice memo with your story to myworld@theworld.org and include your full name, location, and how you listen to The World. We may feature your story on an upcoming show. That's myworld@theworld.org. This week, by rare unanimous bipartisan consent, the Senate passed the Big Cat Public Safety Act. President Biden is expected soon to sign off to make it law. The bill prohibits people from keeping lions, tigers, leopards, and other big cats as pets. It aims to protect animal welfare. Interestingly, though, the bill was framed as a public safety issue to protect people from captive big cats that escape or attack. Sharon Guynup is an investigative journalist with National Geographic Explorer. She's reported extensively on captive tigers in the U.S. and around the globe. Earlier this week, she spoke to my colleague Marco Werman and said the Senate's passage of the act is a huge development.
There has been no federal regulation of big cat ownership in this country. It was a state-to-state patchwork, and in some states, cats were heavily bred for cub petting venues, you know, pulled from their mothers at birth, petted up to 10 hours a day, treated badly, you know, poor food, poor nutrition, poor living conditions, and then discarded once they reached their expiration date at 3 to 4 months when they were too big and dangerous to pet.
Yeah, what does it all mean for the clout of the U.S. internationally now when it comes to the issues of animal welfare and wildlife trafficking?
Well, in China, there are about 6,000 tigers in tiger farms that are literally bred like pigs or chickens for their parts and products. It's a really high-end luxury trade. Tiger skin decor, to a lesser degree, some traditional medicine products. And the U.S. had no clout because our situation here was completely out of control. There was really poor oversight by the USDA over this industry. And one Chinese delegate at a CITES convention, a treaty that regulates wildlife trade and endangered species, A U.S. delegate raised the tiger farm issue with him, and he laughed. He said, "At least we know how many tigers we have." And he walked away.
Wow.
Meanwhile, the U.S. has had incredible clout in forwarding important conservation initiatives across the globe with other animals, other ecosystems, other issues. But we had absolutely no credit in the tiger arena. However, now we will. And there are currently 4 Asian countries raising tigers on farms. It's China, Laos, Vietnam, and Thailand. And feeding that trade in tiger parts also stimulates poaching, which is wiping out, you know, some of the last 4,000 tigers left in the wild.
A few years ago, Sharon, you did an investigation for National Geographic called Captive Tigers in the U.S. Outnumber Those in the Wild. It's a problem. What is the number of tigers in captivity and how did it get so big?
Nobody knows. Nobody has known. At one point, the estimates were far higher than what remained in the wild in Asia. At one point, the estimates were 5,000 to 10,000. I don't know what they are now. Many of the major cub petting tourist attractions have been shut down because of illegal activity. So the numbers have shrunk. Without the constant breeding to have young cubs for tourists to pet, this industry goes away.
So at this point, the tigers in captivity in the U.S., are they primarily from breeding in the U.S. or were they trafficked from other countries?
Initially, they came from other countries. But yes, they've been bred here for this industry, which means they're horribly inbred, very unhealthy. Some have been crossbred. Ligers, Tigons, Thai ligers, and those are really unhealthy cats. The white tigers are not a specific breed. They are severely inbred with very serious health problems.
So the true crime documentary series Tiger King got a lot of notice. It explored the connections between big cat conservationists and collectors and the private zoos and sanctuaries they've set up for public display of these animals. In the end, did Tiger King, you think, help or hinder the efforts to protect these big cats?
Well, our Nat Geo story came out in December of 2019, 3 months before Tiger King, and there was a copy given to every member of Congress. So, you know, things were already moving in terms of greater awareness. You know, people had been working on this for years. Many people have been in the trenches trying to raise concern about both public safety, safety of first responders, as well as really egregious treatment of these animals. There's been serious convictions at many of these outlets that were horrifying. But Tiger King put it on the global stage and certainly at the forefront here in the U.S. and gave people the opportunity to talk about it. So that was really important.
Sharon Guynup is an investigative journalist with National Geographic Explorer who has investigated the plight of captive tigers in the U.S. and in other countries around the globe. She was telling us about the passage of the Big Cat Public Safety Act in Congress. Sharon, thank you very much for discussing this.
Thank you so much.
The World Cup got whittled down to 6 teams today. To state the obvious, all those fans in Qatar didn't know if their team was going to make it through to the final rounds before they bought their plane tickets. So if their team is out, who do they root for now? Or what if you're just a huge soccer fan and your team didn't even make it to the World Cup in the first place? We asked a bunch of fans hanging out between games at Souq Waqif in Doha who they're pulling for and why.
My name is Tamer Abhamim, from Egypt. I support Morocco. Morocco from Africa. I'm from Egypt. We African teams.
So my name is Jai. I am from Philippines. I support England in terms of skills and confidence. I admire them. It's just pure football skills.
My name is Janine Manuel and I'm from Philippines.
I like Messi because he's very humble when he, you know, he scores. Like he always like team up with his his teammates. And like the other ones, like if they go, they go. It seems like they go for themselves, you know.
My name is Abdulrahman, originally from Palestine. I support Netherlands. I am actually a Real Madrid fan. The old days, Real Madrid have many Netherlands players. Yeah. So I like the Netherlands players and I like how he play and everything of Netherlands.
My name is Raju. From Kathmandu, Nepal. I support the Argentina team. My player best is Messi, Lionel Messi.
My name is Noshad Puttukat. I'm from India, Kerala. My favorite is Argentina team.
Maradona, you know, my soul in Kerala people, in Indian people is loving Maradona. He's the great man, in great footballer. And then now we are supporting Messi. I don't know. Messi is a very calm and very decent person. That is why we are loving Argentina.
Reporter Manuel Rueda spoke to World Cup fans from around the world at Souq Waqif in Doha, Qatar. That is where we end things for the week. Enjoy the soccer games this weekend. The World comes to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at GBH in Boston. I'm Carol Hills. Have a penalty-free weekend.
Hi, Marco Werman here with a quick word before we go. Earlier, you heard from reporter Shirin Jafari. She was telling you how your contribution supports our international coverage, like her ongoing reporting on the war in Ukraine. If you value the coverage that Shirin brings, I hope you'll consider donating and bringing us one step closer to unlocking our $67,000 match. Learn more and donate at theworld.org/give. Thank you so much. From PRX.